Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. Today, we're presenting Sherlock Revisited, Part 1. This is in podcast number 83 today. This week and next week, or rather the week after next, we're going to revisit the pages of A Study in Scarlet by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. This is the first of the Sherlock Holmes novels. It was published in 1888 under the title A Tangled Skein. Oh, by the way, did you know that A Study in Scarlet was the first book of detective fiction to incorporate the use of a magnifying glass as an investigative tool? Wikipedia also tells me that the first two film adaptations of this book, both silent films from 1914, are now lost. Now, however, on to the real thing, the book. In A Study in Scarlet, we find out how Watson and Holmes came to be teamed together, and we find that it was all a matter of economics.
"We came here on business," said Stamford, sitting down on a high three-legged stool and pushing another one in my direction with his foot. "My friend here wants to take diggings, and as you were complaining that you could get no one to go halves with you, I thought that I had better bring you together." Sherlock Holmes seemed delighted at the idea of sharing his rooms with me. "I have my eye on a suite in Baker Street," he said, "which would suit us down to the ground. You don't mind the smell of strong tobacco, I hope?"
"I always smoke ships myself," I answered.
"That's good enough. I generally have chemicals about, and occasionally do experiments. Would that annoy you?"
"By no means.
Let me see, what are my other shortcomings? I get in the dumps at times, and don't open my mouth for days on end. You must not think I'm sulky when I do that. Just let me alone, and I'll soon be right. What have you to confess now? It's just as well for two fellows to know the worst of one another before they begin to live together."
I laughed at his cross-examination.
"I keep a bull pup," I said, "and I object to rows because my nerves are shaken, and I get up at all sorts of ungodly hours, and I am extremely lazy. I have another set of vices when I'm well, but those are the principal ones at present."
"Do you include violin playing in your category of rows?" he asked anxiously.
"It depends on the player," I answered. "A well-played violin is a treat for the gods. A badly played one?"
"Oh, that's all right," he cried with a merry laugh. "I think we may consider this thing as settled. That is, if the rooms are agreeable to you."
"When shall we see them?"
"Call for me here at noon tomorrow, and we'll go together and settle everything," he answered.
"All right, noon exactly," said I, shaking his hand. We left him working among his chemicals, and we walked together towards my hotel. "By the way," I asked suddenly, stopping and turning upon Stamford, "how the deuce did he know that I had come from Afghanistan?" My companion smiled an enigmatical smile.
"That's just his little peculiarity," he said. "A good many people have wanted to know how he finds things out."
"Oh, a mystery, is it?" I cried, rubbing my hands. "This is very piquant. I'm much obliged to you for bringing us together. The proper study of mankind is man, you know."
"You must study him, then," Stamford said, as he bade me goodbye. "You'll find him a knotty problem, though. I'll wager he learns more about you than you about him. Goodbye."
"Goodbye," I answered, and strolled on to my hotel, considerably interested in my new acquaintance. As you know, Watson and Holmes wind up at 221 Baker Street, and for a time Watson has no clue as to the profession of Holmes, until one day when he happens upon a magazine article entitled The Book of Life. He reads the article and makes his feelings known to his companion.
"What ineffable twaddle!" I cried, slapping the magazine down on the table. "I never read such rubbish in my life."
"What is it?"
asked Sherlock Holmes. "Why, this article," I said, pointing at it with my egg spoon as I sat down to my breakfast. "I see that you've read it since you have marked it. I don't deny that it is smartly written. It irritates me, though. It is evidently the theory of some armchair lounger who evolves all these neat little paradoxes in the seclusion of his own study. It is not practical. I should like to see him clapped down in the third-class carriage on the Underground and asked to give the trades of all his fellow travellers. I would lay 1,000 to 1 against him."
"You would lose your money," Sherlock Holmes remarked calmly. "As for the article, I wrote it myself."
"You?"
"Yes. I have a turn both for observation and for deduction. The theories which I have expressed there, and which appear to you to be so chimerical, are really extremely practical, so practical that I depend upon them for my bread and cheese."
"And how?" I asked involuntarily.
"Well, I have a trade of my own. I suppose I am the only one in the world. I am a consulting detective, if you can understand what that is. Here in London we have lots of government detectives and lots of private ones. When these fellows are at fault, they come to me, and I manage to put them on the right scent. They lay all the evidence before me, and I am generally able, by the help of my knowledge of the history of crime, to set them straight. There is a strong family resemblance about misdeeds, and if you have all the details of 1,000 at your finger ends, it is odd if you can't unravel the 1,001st. Lestrade is a well-known detective. He got himself into a fog recently over a forgery case,
and that was what brought him here. And these other people?
They are mostly sent on by private inquiry agencies. They are all people who are in trouble about something and want a little enlightening. I listen to their story, they listen to my comments, and then I pocket my fee.
But do you mean to say, I said, that without leaving your room you can unravel some knot which other men can make nothing of, although they have seen every detail for themselves?
Quite so. I have a kind of intuition that way. Now and again a case turns up which is a little more complex. Then I have to bustle about and see things with my own eyes. You see, I have a lot of special knowledge which I apply to the problem, and which facilitates matters wonderfully. These rules of deduction laid down in that article, which aroused your scorn, are invaluable to me in practical work. Observation with me is second nature. You appeared to be surprised when I told you, on our first meeting, that you had come from Afghanistan.
You were told, no doubt.
Nothing of the sort. I knew you came from Afghanistan. From long habit, the train of thoughts ran so swiftly through my mind that I arrived at the conclusion without being conscious of intermediate steps. There were such steps, however. The train of reasoning ran, here is a gentleman of a medical type, but with the air of a military man, clearly an army doctor then. He has just come from the tropics, for his face is dark, and that is not the natural tint of his skin, for his wrists are fair. He has undergone hardship and sickness, as his haggard face says clearly. His left arm has been injured. He holds it in a stiff and unnatural manner. Where in the tropics could an English army doctor have seen much hardship and got his arm wounded? Clearly, in Afghanistan. The whole train of thought did not occupy a second. I then remarked that you came from Afghanistan, and you were astonished.
It is simple enough as you explain it, I said, smiling. You remind me of Edgar Allan Poe's Dupin.
It isn't long before Holmes is called upon to investigate a prickly case which London detectives cannot unravel. Holmes invites Watson to come with him to the crime scene at 3 Lauriston Gardens, off the Brixton Road.
A short passage, bare-planked and dusty, led to the kitchen and offices. Two doors opened out of it to the left and to the right. One of these had obviously been closed for many weeks. The other belonged to the dining room, which was the apartment in which the mysterious affair had occurred. Holmes walked in, and I followed him with that subdued feeling at my heart which the presence of death inspires. It was a large square room, looking all the larger from the absence of all furniture. A vulgar flaring paper adorned the walls, but it was blotched in places with mildew, and here and there great strips had become detached and hung down, exposing the yellow plaster underneath. Opposite the door was a showy fireplace, surmounted by a mantelpiece of imitation white marble. On the corner of this was stuck the stump of a red wax candle. The solitary window was so dirty that the light was hazy and uncertain, giving a dull gray tinge to everything, which was intensified by the thick layer of dust which coated the whole apartment. All these details I observed afterwards. At present, my attention was centered upon the single, grim, motionless figure which lay stretched upon the boards, with vacant, sightless eyes staring up at the discolored ceiling. It was that of a man about 43 or 44 years of age, middle-sized, broad-shouldered, with crisp, curling black hair and a short, stubbly beard. He was dressed in a heavy, broadcloth frock coat and waistcoat, with light-colored trousers and immaculate collar and cuffs. A top hat, well brushed and trim, was placed on the floor beside him. His hands were clenched, and his arms thrown abroad, while his lower limbs were interlocked as though his death struggle had been a grievous one. On his rigid face there stood an expression of horror, and, as it seemed to me, of hatred, such as I have never seen upon human features. This malignant and terrible contortion, combined with the low forehead, blunt nose, and prognathous jaw, gave the dead man a singularly simious and ape-like appearance, which was increased by his writhing, unnatural posture. I have seen death in many forms, but never has it appeared to me in a more fearsome aspect than in that dark, grimy apartment which looked out upon one of the main arteries of suburban London. Lestrade, lean and ferret-like as ever, was standing by the doorway and greeted my companion and myself. "This case will make a stir, sir," he remarked. "It beats anything I've seen, and I am no chicken." "There is no clue," said Gregson. "None at all," chimed in Lestrade. Sherlock Holmes approached the body and, kneeling down, examined it intently. "You are sure that there is no wound?" he asked, pointing to numerous gouts and splashes of blood which lay all around.
"Positive,"
cried both detectives.
"Then, of course, this blood belongs to a second individual, presumably the murderer, if murder has been committed. It reminds me of the circumstances attendant on the death of Van Jansen in Utrecht in the year 34. Do you remember the case, Gregson?"
"No, sir."
"Read it up. You really should. There is nothing new under the sun. It has all been done before."
As he spoke, his nimble fingers were flying here, there, and everywhere, feeling, pressing, unbuttoning, examining, while his eyes wore the same faraway expression which I have already remarked upon. So swiftly was the examination made that one would hardly have guessed the minuteness with which it was conducted. Finally he sniffed the dead man's lips, and then glanced at the soles of his patent leather boots.
"He has not been moved at all?"
he asked. "No more than was necessary for the purposes of our examination."
"You can take him to the mortuary now," he said. "There is nothing more to be learned."
Gregson had a stretcher and four men at hand. At his call they entered the room, and the stranger was lifted and carried out. As they raised him, A ring tinkled down and rolled across the floor. Lestrade grabbed it up and stared at it with mystified eyes.
"There's been a woman here," he cried. "It's a woman's wedding ring."
He held it out as he spoke upon the palm of his hand. We all gathered round him and gazed at it. There could be no doubt that that circlet of plain gold had once adorned the finger of a bride.
"This complicates matters," said Gregson. "Heaven knows they were complicated enough before."
"You sure it doesn't simplify them?" observed Holmes. "There's nothing to be learned by staring at it. What did you find in his pockets?"
"We have it all here," said Gregson, pointing to a litter of objects upon one of the bottom steps of the stairs. "A gold watch, number 97163, by Barat of London, gold Albert chain, very heavy and solid, gold ring with Masonic device, gold pin, bulldog's head with rubies as eyes, Russian leather hard case with cards of Enoch J. Drebber of Cleveland, corresponding with the EJD upon the linen, no purse, but loose money to the extent of £7.13, pocket edition of Boccaccio's Decameron, with the name Joseph Stangerson upon the flyleaf, two letters, one addressed to E.J. Drebber, and one to Joseph Stangerson.
At what address?
American Exchange, Strand, to be left till called for. They are both from the Guion Steamship Company, and refer to the sailing of their boats from Liverpool. It is clear that this unfortunate man was about to return to New York.
Have you made any inquiries as to this man Stangerson?
I did it at once, sir, said Gregson. I've had advertisements sent to all the newspapers, and one of my men has gone to the American Exchange, but he has not returned yet.
Have you sent to Cleveland?
We telegraphed this morning.
How did you word your inquiries?
We simply detailed the circumstances, and said that we should be glad of any information which could help us.
You did not ask for particulars on any point which appeared to you to be crucial.
I ask about Stangerson.
Nothing else.
Is there no circumstance on which this whole case appears to hinge?
Will you not telegraph again?
I've said all I have to say, said Gregson, in an offended voice.
Sherlock Holmes chuckled to himself, and appeared to be about to make some remark, when Lestrade, who had been in the front room while we were holding this conversation in the hall, reappeared upon the scene, rubbing his hands in a pompous and self-satisfied manner.
With various twists and turns, of course, Holmes puts his finger on the matter and solves the case.
"All this seems strange to you," continued Holmes, "because you failed at the beginning of the inquiry to grasp the importance of the single real clue which was presented to you. I had the good fortune to seize upon that, and everything which has occurred since then has served to confirm my original supposition, and indeed was the logical sequence of it. Hence things which have perplexed you and made the case more obscure have served to enlighten me and to strengthen my conclusions. It is a mistake to confound strangeness with mystery. The most commonplace crime is often the most mysterious, because it now presents no new or special features from which deductions may be drawn. This murder would have been infinitely more difficult to unravel had the body of the victim been simply found lying in the roadway without any of those entrées and the sensational accompaniments which have rendered it remarkable. These strange details, far from making the case more difficult, have really had the effect of making it less so."
Mr. Gregson, who had listened to this address with a considerable impatience, could contain himself no longer.
"Look here, Mr. Sherlock Holmes," he said. "We are all ready to acknowledge that you are a smart man, and that you have your own methods of working. We want something more than mere theory and preaching now, though. It is a case of taking the man. I have made my case out, and it seems I was wrong. Young Charpentier could not have been engaged in this second affair.
Lestrade went after his man, Stangerson, and it appears that he was wrong, too. You have thrown out hints here and hints there, and seem to know more than we do, but the time has come when we feel that we have the right to ask you straight out, how much do you know of this business? Can you name the man who did it?
I cannot help feeling that Gregson is right, sir, remarked Lestrade. We have both tried, and we have both failed. You have remarked more than once since I have been in the room that you had all the evidence which you require. Surely you will not withhold it any longer.
Any delay in arresting the assassin, I observed, might give him time to perpetrate some fresh atrocity. Thus pressed by us all, Holmes showed signs of irresolution. He continued to walk up and down the room with his head sunk on his chest and his brows drawn down, as was his habit when lost in thought.
"There will be no more murders," he said at last, stopping abruptly and facing us. "You can put that consideration out of the question. You have asked me if I know the name of the assassin. I do. The mere knowing of his name is a small thing, however, compared with the power of laying our hands upon him. This I expect very shortly to do. I have good hopes of managing it through my own arrangements, but it is a thing which needs delicate handling, for we have a shrewd and desperate man to deal with, who is supported, as I have occasion to prove, by another who is as clever as himself. As long as this man has no idea that anyone can have a clue, there is some chance of securing him. But if he had the slightest suspicion, he would change his name and vanish in an instant among the 4 million inhabitants of this great city. Without meaning to hurt either of your feelings, I am bound to say that I consider these men to be more than a match for the official force, and that is why I have not asked for your assistance. If I fail, I shall, of course, incur all the blame due to this omission, but that I am prepared for. At present, I'm ready to promise that the instant that I can communicate with you without endangering my own combinations, I shall do so. Gregson and Lestrade seem to be far from satisfied by this assurance, or by the depreciating allusion to the detective police. The former had flushed up to the roots of his flaxen hair, while the other's beady eyes glistened with curiosity and resentment. Neither of them had time to speak, however, before there was a tap at the door, and the spokesman of the street Arabs, young Wiggins, introduced his insignificant and unsavory person.
"Please, sir," he said, touching his forelock, "I have a cab downstairs."
"Good boy," said Holmes blandly. "Why don't you introduce this pattern at Scotland Yard?" he continued, taking a pair of steel handcuffs from the drawer. "See how beautifully the spring works. They fasten in an instant."
"The old pattern is good enough," marked Lestrade, "if we can only find the man to put them on."
"Very good, very good," said Holmes, smiling. "The cabman may as well help me with my boxes. Just ask him to step up, Wiggins."
I was surprised to find my companion speaking as though he were about to set on a journey, since he had not said anything to me about it. There was a small portmanteau in the room, and this he pulled out and began to strap. He was busily engaged at it when the cabman entered the room.
"Just give me some help with this buckle, cabman," he said, kneeling over his task and never turning his head.
The fellow came forward with a somewhat sullen, defiant air, and put down his hands to assist. At that instant there was a sharp click, the jangling of metal, and Sherlock Holmes sprang to his feet again.
"Gentlemen," he cried with flashing eyes, "let me introduce you to Mr. Jefferson Hope, the murderer of Enoch Drebber and of Joseph Stangerson."
Holmes solves the case and captures the culprit. You may say I've spoiled the book by revealing the name of the murderer. Let me assure you that that is not the case. Doyle himself reveals the name in the middle of the book. There is a second part to this story, which is set in the American West, which gives us the background of Mr. Jefferson Hope and the reason for the murders which were committed.
Because of time constraints, I can't play any segments from the second section of the book. However, if you will check back again in 2 weeks, I'll fill in with samples from that section of A Study in Scarlet. Next week is the week which includes Veterans Day. That's Friday, November 11th. We'll pay tribute to our vets that day. Join me for a special program next Wednesday. That's our time for this week. I hope you've enjoyed these samples. Check my website, narrationbygeorge.com, for the outlets for downloading your copy of this book. You're going to find a special price mentioned on the website. That's narrationbygeorge.com/books. Click on the icon at the top of the page for A Study in Scarlet. You can also share your comments and feedback on Facebook. Look up Narration by George or go to Twitter and follow me at Narration by Geo or send me an email. I'm George@narrationbygeorge.com. Join me next Wednesday when this podcast will once again be new. And remember, God has blessed you. Share that blessing with someone else.